Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. I'm Ruth McKee, editor of Books Ireland, and joining me today is author Audrey McGee. Audrey's first novel, The Undertaking, was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction and for France's Festival du Premier Roman. Sarah Moss describes her new novel, The Colony, as a vivid and memorable book about art, youth, love and sex, land and language. Audrey, I want to bring you back to your childhood, really, and where you grew up. I don't really know much about your background or where you were as a little girl, but if you tell me a little bit about that and maybe how you came to reading and, you know, what books, if any, from that period you would pull from the flames if your house was on fire?
So I am actually still in the same place where I grew up. I grew up in Enniskerry and I'm still here. Was a teenager here, desperate to get out because it was a very quiet, rural, really nothing on, kind of going on kind of place. The 44 bus would turn up and you'd be like, oh my God, is there anybody on it? Please let there be somebody on it. Then I travelled a huge amount, lived abroad, and then kind of had kids and was fortunate enough to be able to come back. It's a hard place to come back to. And now I live here and yeah, it's been great. It's a kind of full kind of circle, and that, you know, to some degree I came back to write because I suppose it's a quiet place, and it made it easy. It's a very, coming back made it easy for me to be still and digest.
It's funny because a lot of writers, a lot of creative people would say that it's very hard to create and to have that sort of freedom and license to maybe say uncomfortable things or even just to be that creative person in the environment where you grew up. Did you not find the same thing?
No, I don't. I probably find it very comforting to have that level of security outside the space that I go into. Because, you know, the spaces I go into aren't always comfortable places. You know, the first novel and both novels have a lot of violence in them. So I think you need a very secure hinterland for that. And I think Enniskerry kind of gives me that, and I'm deeply grateful to it for that, because I can go in there and then come out again. And yeah, so no, it's...
So it's like you have this...
Probably very pivotal to my capacity to write, I think, actually, ironically. I mean, you're absolutely right. Most people have to leave. Cézanne went back to his... to his place, you know, his original place.
His birthplace.
Yeah, yeah, but that was to live with his mother and sister. And I think that was, that was more traumatic for him.
Yes, kind of much. Yeah.
But, you know, we've kind of, yeah, no, I do really appreciate this hinterland and the security of that hinterland.
Do you think maybe as well, I was reading from your notes that you say you were away, you're talking about languages and maybe French and German and things like that. Is that something that kind of opened you up and then you were able to kind of bring that back with you?
Yeah, I think it's the kind of, I mean, there are so many people my age who left Ireland, you know, desperate to get out and then came back. There are so many of us, or people who are coming back now, you know, retiring back here. You know, there wasn't an awful lot going on. You know, we have to be very clear about this. 1970s, 1980s Ireland, you know, that was a hard place, particularly when young and particularly when female. So, you know, yeah, it was very good to go. And definitely, you know, I left here. First time I left, I was 13 and I went to France, and I had no French. I just landed in, I got on the boat. Basically, what had happened was I joined the Girl Guides for adventure. And I went through, you know, went through everything, all the learning, all the everything, because we were going to have an adventure and a summer adventure. And the adventure was to go up to Paris Court. And I said, yeah, OK, no, this isn't enough. So I got in a boat and went to France and ended up on this with this family who were terrific. But they had no English and I had no French. So it was kind of like sink or swim. And so that was, that kind of immersion was huge for me because it was so different, you know. And I kind of kept doing that. I kept traveling. I kept going. And then, I suppose maybe to some degree to digest, but also to be still, you know. And funnily enough, I remember in France many, many years ago, so many years ago, having this debate with a man who was staying in his small place, in his village, in his somewhere in Brittany, I can't remember where. And he was saying, you know, what's all this traveling? You don't need to travel, you know. And he looked at all his books. He said, it's all here. And I was saying, no, you have to feel it. You have to go. You have to sense it and to understand it yourself. And he's going, I understand it. But that stayed with me because then I ended up coming right back and going, okay, I'll be still. And, you know, and I had to be still and I had to force myself to write. I had to impose this stillness, which was really difficult because I'm not naturally a kind of a still person, do you know? So,
but that early experience, someone you say even at 13 is incredible, even, you know, linguistically, to have those channels opened up so early, that sense of kind of otherness and touching, that kind of that weird sort of excitement, sort of fear, excitement, wonder that you get with the different and the new at that age, especially coming from somewhere so quiet and so rural in Ireland.
Yeah. And it's hard to believe how quiet and rural it was, because at the time it was 12 miles. It still is obviously 12 miles from Dublin, but it was really quiet. It was a really quiet place, but it was a beautiful place to grow up as a kid, because, you know, it was, you could have been anywhere in Ireland. It was so small and safe and everybody knew each other and all that. But I desperately needed to go, you know. I desperately needed to, you know, and you know, we were rare to go. That's the thing. Our parents of that generation, you know, gave us the wings to go. You know, you were encouraged out the door and you were never made afraid of what was out there, you know. At least we weren't. Sorry, we weren't. I mean, I had great parents who just, you know, said, go, get out there. That's so I did.
You did. So, bringing it back to books at that time, and that's a bit of a span there, going from when you were very small to maybe when you were a teenager and growing up. Is there, or are there books from that period that you would save or that are treasures to you or that matter to you?
I mean, I still have them. That's the thing. It's that I have them, and one of them is here right in front of me because I dug it out for you, and it's called In the Jungle. And a woman called Linda. And Linda, I can't remember you, but it's L-Y-N-D-A. And you said to Audrey, Merry Xmas, love Linda with an X. And I was probably two or three. I don't know what age I was, maybe three or four. I can't remember the age. I just remember the moment of receiving this book and the colours. And look at all the colours. Look at all the, like.
That's the actual book.
That's the actual same book. Oh, yeah, no, it's the same book. Yeah, you know, so I'm very, I keep things. And I don't keep much things, many things. I keep books. I absolutely, look at that. I mean, I went over these pages thousands of times. I mean, thousands of times. So, you know, I'm deeply grateful to you, Linda. That was the start of it all.
Maybe we'll find her. Maybe she'll be listening to this and we'll find
Linda. Linda with a Y.
Linda with a Y. Who gave a book called In the Jungle?
In the Jungle, yes.
In the Jungle.
Ah, look, it was
to Audrey just, McGee,
yeah,
when she was
gave
three.
It to me in Enniskerry when I was, you know, tiny, tiny thing.
And do you read that book to your own children, or did you read
Yeah, I've shown it to them. I said, now, this was my first ever book. No. I mean, look, there's not a lot in it for the current generation of young readers. They have much more dynamic things going on. But that book was, you know, it was just so vibrant, the colors, the counting, the, you know, hiding things hidden. You know, there was no color, you know, back then. Like, you know, television was black and white, everything was pretty much black and white. The whole concept of color was, you know, hard to find, really. And it's not, it wasn't, it was a great life. It's not that it was, but it was just when something colourful came in. I'm, you know, I remember my dad talking about, because he grew up here, he was born here. And, you know, he'd talk about, you know, the first time they saw a football, do you know? So it's a bit like that. It was a bit, you know, it was still the legacy of that, that, you know, we weren't in his era, but we weren't that far removed from it either.
Yes.
You know, we could still link back to what he had experienced in Enniskerry. And we could still, and we, you know, my mother in Wexford, you know, we could have, whereas for my kids, that's just utterly.
Yes, it's the olden days, isn't it? Yeah, it's
not just another century, it's another millennium, you know?
Yeah, my kids say, like, when the dinosaurs roamed the land, you know, it feels that far removed from them, just in absolutely every sense, nearly. Yeah. You know?
Whereas I think, you know, we probably had a little bit more direct links with those, the things our parents would have gone through.
Yeah. So you say, like, so you just said there a wee while ago that you do keep books, you keep some books.
Yeah. So the other ones were Heidi. I still have that. I Am David by Anne Holm. The Silver Sword by Ian Serralier.
Yes.
Like, I have them.
Oh, that's gorgeous that you still have the actual copies that you read. It's beautiful.
I've literally gone around like a mad woman with my kids going, now in fairness, they've read them, but they just went off, got their own copies going, God, that's so dated. But, you know, so yeah, like they've been, like they were just from the very beginning, they were pivotal to me, you know, and I always went up to the, you know, the bedrooms upstairs, the hall, the landings upstairs to read and retreat. And, you know, that's what I did. Yeah. Because we lived in the village. So, you know, it was when you live in a village, it's a busy place. And I liked to kind of
squirrel away. Yeah. I remember similar. You used the word pivotal there a minute ago again, about some of these books and moments. And I wanted to ask you, and I don't know at what period you read the book that you mentioned here to me, but you said that there's a book that really was a kind of a, maybe not a turning point, but certainly some sort of revelation to you in a lot of senses. Would you tell me about that book?
So that was Moderato Cantabile by Marguerite Duras. And that's it here. That's the original copy. That's my handwriting from.
Oh, you've got your notes.
I've got all my notes
in the margins.
Yeah, but I write in pen, which is really, you know, pen and pencil.
Oh,
and
yeah, I do. Destroyed. I love that.
But back then, I wrote in pen on them. Terrible. Anyway, so I was chugging along, doing my thing as a reader, as a, you know, a fifth year student in school, and you know, it was all Dickens, it was Austen, it was, oh, you know, the usual. And then my French teacher Joan Dobbin, to whom I today also pay homage, presented Moderato Cantabile. It was her choice to do, you know, whatever she wanted. And it was just such a hugely exciting moment in my reading, because for the first time, there was space for me. Then there was space for me as a reader, because Duras writes really sparely. It's not that it's not spare like Beckett. It's more filled in than Beckett. But it's just, she just creates these coat hangers of characters, and there's space for you, and there's space for you as a reader, and there's space for you to engage with characters and engage with Duras and Duras' thinking. And that was just revolutionary, because prior to that, you're kind of fed this diet of this is what to think, and this is how to think, and this is how to write, and this is how. And it was just so exciting. It was so exciting. Nobody else knew I was excited. This was just very internal excitement. And it was just so pivotal. It was so extraordinarily important to me to meet this book. And then it was great, because my French teacher then decided, I don't know, maybe I was displaying this enthusiasm, but she decided to that we were going to perform the first section of the book. So myself and my friend Helen was the piano teacher, and I was Anne Desbarrestes, And so I was the mother whose son is having a piano lesson. And it made me even further understand her language, because I had to, you know, just pare it back and then present it on stage and understand every single nuance of the words she was using. And just, you know, that was obviously in French, but it was just so thrilling to be so immersed in this woman's work. And that stayed with me. And obviously I went on and I did French in college and did Dora again.
I wanted to ask you about language there, because, you know, well, for a start, I mean, I'm thinking what Wendy Erskine said. I was chatting to her on the last Burning Books, and we were talking just about what you were talking about there, about when you have a teacher who can sort of steer the reader, or like, you know, he like that, chooses a book like that, you know, that's way off the kind of formulaic curriculum, and it's that sort of influence that can be so transformative, you know, and just so unique as well. But for you, like, how did that, you know, you're talking about kind of inhabiting that text, especially when you were on stage, and that, you know, through French, there's obviously something else that is kind of enlivened in you. Did that kind of push you towards books in other languages, or in translation, or into like more European literature in general?
Definitely, yeah. No, definitely. It definitely changed the way I read, and it changed fundamentally the way I wrote. The language thing was, I mean, I laugh at this. It's like, is this why I do so much dialogue? Was it because there were huge tracts of text I just didn't understand? I was waiting for the dialogue when I go, oh yeah, okay, got it now. But no, just when you are learning to read in another language, you have to understand nuance so much more. You have to work with any fragments you do understand and make those fragments become really important, because actually that's where you're getting your meaning, and that's where you're, and I suppose it imbues in you this sense that, well, actually everything matters, you know, because you understand then the building blocks, because as a linguist, you're building blocks all the time. And it makes you just very aware of the links between one phrase and another phrase. I would have, particularly in French in UCD, I would have done a lot of translation work, you know, mm-hmm. translating texts. And, you know, I just really adored that work. I loved that kind of that minutiae of language and movement and shift and change. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, the shift and change of it particularly, isn't it? When you translate into English.
Yeah, and then the what is carried in a word that doesn't exist in the other language, and then vice versa. So, you know, when you do it, and then I was doing two languages, and then originally I did French, German and linguistics. So I did linguistics for first year there. So, it was a very kind of immersive space for me, you know, out of which, you know, the flip side is that I came out going, oh God, should I have done English? I don't know. I still want to write. Do I want to write? No, I can't write. I never did English. So I spent a lot of time trying to overcome that lack of confidence, because you're not an English graduate. So therefore, mm-hmm. you know, you don't know anything. So, do you know, so that actually became, so it took me, but in the end, you know, as my mother says, it came good for you, because, you know, you did see the world differently, you know.
And absolutely, I think it comes for me. I'm reading your book at the moment. I'm reading the Colony. There's language again. At the moment, and to me, one of the most sort of integral things to it is the joy in the words. You know, in a very deep sense, how words are. Even, well, you know, you can if you want to tell the listeners a little bit about the premise of the book, and then that might make more sense.
So the Colony is about an English artist who lands on an Irish island. It's an unnamed Irish island in the summer of 1979. And he is there certain that he is alone with the islanders, and that it's just him in this space where, for him to do his art. But then a French linguist arrives on the island. And it turns out that actually he's been visiting the island over several summers because he's doing his doctorate of his postgrad studies on the evolution or demise of the Irish language. And it's an Irish speaking island. And basically, the two men, if you like, create the framework for a discussion and exploration, really, on colonization, on what it is to be colonized and what it is to be the colonizer, because it's about their interactions with language, with art, but with the islanders, and then the islanders' reactions to them. And I suppose I'm exploring these kind of latent behaviors in us, these tiny little things that we do in our language, in our hands, in our gestures, that have been learnt because of colonization. And it's whether because you are the colonized or you are the colonizer. So it's really that. It's really using the space to explore that. And you know, that obviously there are narratives going on within the on the island and relationships and everything else, but they're all under this pressure because of these two men on the field who on the island, who Banny Flynn, one of the old woman on the island, calls, you know, two bulls in the field, yeah. You know, because they're just always at each other trying to be dominant. And, you know, I suppose obviously it's an island, but it is metaphorically the island of Ireland, and the history of obviously British colonization, but also how Ireland was a template for colonization that was then brought around the world by the French, by the Dutch, obviously by the British, all around the world. Just how colonization uses language as a weapon against the people. It's a method of control, religion, you know, and the way it divides people, whether it's Catholics, Protestants, Hutus, Tutsis, you know, it's all about division. It's all about control. So it's all that. And what is the legacy of that? Because, you know, it's interesting when you say, you know, the influence of other countries on my other languages, on my writing, but also just other countries, because I suppose did so much French literature, you're exposed to African interpretations of colonization, then British interpretation, African-British relationships, colonization, Nigerian literature, so Australian literature. So I would have read a ton. I was always drawn to colonization, colonial literature, post-colonial literature, like over, you know, we're talking over 30 years here. And it's like, you know, we don't see ourselves as colonized. We don't see ourselves the way other countries and other people see themselves. And I wanted to look at that because that to me was very interesting. So it's done through this book.
And yet you do it with such a beautiful palette and in such a sort of intimate, atmospheric and rhythmic way. I mean, all of those concepts and themes and you know, question marks that you're bringing up there, but it's all done in such a sort of beautiful, you know, it's just incredibly accomplished. I don't know how you managed to get so much, I suppose, philosophy of language to me in there. Like there was even on a very personal level, is it Seamus? You keep saying, call me James. My name is James. You know, there's that, just even right back down to the, you know, to making the tea, or to, it's just, it's quite theatrical as well. It was funny because you were just talking about Duras earlier and your kind of early experience of inhabiting that book on the stage. To me, it's quite cinematographic as well, or quite theatrical in the way it's, to me, I mean, this is just my take from it. It feels like it's being played out in front of me. It's you know, and the cliffscapes and the islandscape, it's very dramatic.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in that kind of Kammerspiel, the chamber piece in theatre. So the first novel was very much written as a chamber piece, you know. Mm-hmm. I really wanted people to actually think about what about fascism and what it is like to be the ordinary German during the Second World War. And kind of I had to create an atmosphere that you actually just couldn't leave, because we need to talk about this. You know, we need to, like, so, you know, the one act play is absolutely a brilliant format, because nobody can leave. Nobody can. So I, and in a way, the island is the same thing. You can't get off here. We're all on this together now. We need to talk about this. And we need to kind of, we need to just look at, you know, what happens with people. What happens with all these characters as they interact? And it is about, it is absolutely trying to create that that really intimate space of a theatre, mm-hmm. you know, that we all miss so hugely. But, you know, that just theatre is the most extraordinary interactive experience. I adore theatre. And just to give yourself as a reader or a viewer that space to immerse yourself is just, for me, it's a gift, and I really try. Yeah, I do try to recreate that, because it's hard to find that time or that space to think about these things. And yeah. Going into a dark room actually is a good environment to, yeah. you know. So yeah, no, I would owe a lot, I think, to theatre and that the theater. Sense of yeah. being.
This is a terrible question I'm going to ask you, but it, you know, of the books that are not just your published books, but of the things that you have written since, you know, leaving university or whenever it was you first started to put words down on the page, what would you, of all of the things that you've written, which one would you see if you had to pull something out of a burning house?
Okay, so I am a very slow writer, so I have a very slow digestive process. So so my books, because they are so slow in their production, they, you know, everything else I just have to let go. I think the one I don't know what's going to happen with this book that's got its own journey now, but the Undertaking had a great trip. Like we had a great time together, and we really did. We had a ball. And one of the things that happened was it was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. And, you know, you go to the ceremony in London and you have to read in front of 900 people. Now, you must understand, I had previously read to the Parish Hall. You know, you're in the Royal Festival Hall and all this stuff. So it was pretty mind-blowing. And by the time it came to the actual prize award ceremony thing, whatever you want to say about prizes or whatever, you know, whatever, you're in the middle of it. And, you know. But you're handed, I was handed flowers, but I was also handed this thing that I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was, but I kind of tucked one into the other. And then I realized, oh, it was a book. It was my book, but I have my book, whatever. You know, and there are cameras and there's like, oh, it's just like, you know. So so I had the flowers and I had the book, and then my agent, a really great guy, Peter Strauss, kind of looked at me and he just kind of took the book because I was getting pollen on it from the flowers. There were lilies, and he was like, you know, don't you understand? And I was like, what? And it was only later I understood that it was a handbound book. It was a handbound version of The Undertaking. Somebody had actually taken my Undertaking and bound it by hand.
Oh.
But what was beautiful about that final realization, and it's got a tiny little bit of pollen on it from that night, so it's kind of cute, but was that what made it particularly special was that when I lived in Germany, I shared a Wohngemeinschaft, like a kind of a common living area, with a young man who was a bookbinder. And he used to take like your beaten up travel books, like your Let's Go Europe, whatever, and bind them for you. So you ended up like being the most sophisticated traveler in Europe with your leather bound book. But here I was kind of this realization of this kind of full circle. I'd written about his country and somebody now had taken this book and bound it by hand. So that would have to come. That would have to come with me. But I would try and save everything else, just like while I was at it. And, you know, in the jungle would have to come too, and Heidi, and, you know, oh my God, that was just the most, it's the most traumatic concept.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask you what you would leave in there to burn, because I suspect nothing.
I couldn't at part anyway, you know, because I think too of the German thing in me, the German teaching in me of, and learning in me of book burning. I just, no, everything. You know, I would have my wheelbarrows. I would have everything. I would just be in and out with wheelbarrows and trucks, whatever. I'd do anything to get as many.
To get them all out. Yeah. I'm just thinking of the bookbinder. If anyone's listening, that would make a beautiful short story to start with. The bookbinder in Germany. Who binds travel books? Oh, that's just, there's just, I can just see that. I'm going to finish off with the last question, which is not about books. It's about something else that you would save from your house that's not a book item, but has value for you.
It would have to be my dad's letters, I think. My dad was a man who left school after the Intercert, you know, just had to go then and work. He worked in the butcher shop in the village. He was a voracious reader and just an extraordinary writer, actually. And when I lived abroad, I think that's probably one of the most precious things was that he used to write these letters, giving you full dissertations of what was happening in the village. But also just he would throw in these things, you know, about like etymological roots of cardio and, you know, cardio being hinge, you know, and cardiologist working on the heart and the hinge of the body. I was just like, they went on and on and on. And it was, they're glorious to have. And I feel so honoured to have kept them. Another thing I keep. But I feel so honoured to have them still, and to have that piece of him. Obviously he's long gone now, but so they would definitely have to come, because put it this way, I didn't lick it off a stick, you know. So yeah, and you can see that in those letters, that he had a capacity for seeing things that was just extraordinary, you know.
Yeah, so do you. So to finish off, Audrey, if you could read a little bit for us from your book The Colony, that would be really a nice way to finish up.
Okay, I'd be honoured to. He left. She washed the plates and cutlery and stoked the fire. She sat down and lifted the charcoal grey knitting from the basket at the side of the chair. The start of a jumper for James. Dark to hide the dirt. She stretched the knitting across her lap and counted. 8 rows done. 2 to go, 1 row plain, 1 row pearl. Ready in time for school, James, if you ever go back. Back to those priests and their ways. She started to knit, sliding one needle over the other and looping the wool. They're quietening of you, James. They're stilling of you, and your nails chewed to the quick. She finished the cuff at the base of the jumper and added 6 extra stitches to each side. She knitted on, rows of plain and pearl to build the foundations of the pattern to come. Her own pattern, her design as she knitted it for Liam, now for James, who tells me nothing. Insists only that I shouldn't worry. They don't like me because I'm an island boy, ma'am. But don't worry, ma'am, because I don't like them either. She counted the stitches, 134. As it is in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, the knitter's prayer. She continued, 3 more rows, plain, pearl, plain. She stretched the knitting across her thighs, counted the stitches one more time and started on her pattern. Blackberry stitch, cable, moss, diamond up the middle and out the other side in reverse, moss, cable, blackberry. She knitted the first blackberry, binding 3 stitches from 1, gathering them, wrapping them in pearl and pushing through the birth of a berry to texture the jumper. She smiled and stroked the woolen knot, a thickening of the wool to keep James warm, as it warmed me, knitted by my mother, though not my grandmother, who still calls this English knitting, the English scheme. Their guilt for the famine, for the land theft. They take our land, she says, starve us, and then to alleviate the poverty, to assuage their guilt, they set us up with knitting. Make jumpers this way and sell them, they said. Earn your living that way, they said. Earn your rent that way, they said. Though we liked earning our living the other way, from the land that was our land, the sea that was our sea. But they told us to knit, so now we knit. Well, I'm not knitting, said Fanny Flynn. Not that knitting, their Scottish, English, Irish knitting. I'll do my own knitting. Knit as my mother did, as my grandmother knitted. Mairead laughed at Fanny Flynn sitting up there still by the fire with her pipe, her tea and her knitting. Defiant, making socks that nobody wants to wear anymore. Socks with patterns more intricate than these jumpers. Socks of waves and weaves, twists and turns. Socks that sit in a drawer because my father, her daughter's husband, was the last islander to wear them. Dozens of socks in that drawer waiting for him to come back from the sea. Mairead smiled. At least his feet won't be cold when he comes back from the sea and opens that drawer of socks. She knitted on. 20 plain stitches, the foundation of the cable that will run up the side of James's chest, from his hip bones to his clavicle. Then the moss stitch, plain purl, plain purl, the knitting soothing in the stillness of the sleeping house, the sleeping village. Her metal needles sliding one over the other to build the base of the diamond pattern that would run up the centre of the jumper, along James's chest, still skinny, though his voice is broken, and he is shaved once or twice, his chin only surreptitiously. The hair is washed away, the blade hidden, his father's blade without his father's guidance, without the guidance of a man. For the priests are of no use to him, those men in frocks, and he has no time for me, Hall, even less for Francis, his own uncle. Though he likes the Englishman well enough. Maybe he talks to the Englishman as he would have talked to his father. A man of little use to him now under the sea in one of these jumpers, dark like this one. A bed now for fish, a blanket for crabs. The wool more enduring than his skin and flesh, than his black, black hair. But what of your bones, Liam? The marrow of your bones, of you, what is left of them? Of you, my love, down there, underneath in the sea, grave, the grave sea. Is anything left, or are you all gone? Eaten, atomized, diluted and dispersed, carried from one ocean to the next, tiny particles of you travelling around the earth. My husband in Australia, in Africa, in South America, travelling the world without me, though he promised that we would go together, leave together, the three of us. But you left without me, Liam, without us.
You've been listening to Audrey McGee reading from her new book, The Colony. And this has been Burning Books, supported by the Arts Council of Ireland. And I'm Rhys McGee, editor of Books Ireland. See you all again.